Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Carl from Carl's Tavern. I'd like to welcome everybody that's listening. We have a very interesting show tonight. It's a show that I've been planning for a couple months now, and we'll have Jeffrey here talk about that for a moment. But we're going to be talking about porn and basically the social impact of it, how it's changed our look at sexuality, both straight and gay. And I'd like to introduce my two guests today. One is author and historian Jeffrey Escoffier. Say hello, Jeffrey.
Hello. Glad to meet you all.
Okay. And we also have Whitney Strub. Whitney, say hello. And
hey, how's it going? Good to be here.
Okay, good. So guys, you're both, you know, historians, and you take a look at this subject, porn, from different areas and different perspectives. So, Jeffrey, you look at it particularly from a gay perspective. Let's just give us a little bit of background, how you got involved in this and why it's a fascinating subject to you.
Well, I have always been interested in porn. I can remember softcore in those days. But for me, when I started writing about porn around 2000. And the reason I got interested in it, the first article that I wrote was about gay for pay actors. And I became interested in how did people make porn. I didn't feel like I could ever be a porn star. And so I was curious as to how people became porn stars and what they had to do and how they felt. And so I basically started meeting people and interviewing people and talking to people in the porn business, and then began to write about that. And so that, to some extent, is how I started. And then I write on history of sexuality also. And so I sort of combined those two things. And I go back and forth between writing about most of my writing about porn. Well, I would say half of my writing about porn is about making porn and the production process. And the other half is about the historical significance of porn and how it's affected us. And also I'm very interested in sex and how porn represents sex.
Okay. Because porn and sex are actually two different things, correct?
Yes, that's correct. That's correct.
Okay.
But there is some kind of something like sex in porn. We can talk about that because that's a big issue.
Yeah, I'll give you a little bit of background when we get back to this subject here in a moment. I'm going to let Whitney give us a little bit of background on how he got started and what his connection is with this subject.
Yeah, sure. So I was growing up in the 1980s in rural Alaska, where groups like the Moral Majority were super active and visible, and they were always protesting and picketing outside of places like 7-Eleven for carrying adult magazines. And, you know, I always found that pretty off-putting, and never quite understood why it got them so fired up that people were, you know, naked in these magazines. And that question kind of lingered with me. And then years later, I was in grad school in the early 21st century when a lot of political historians were looking at the emergence of what's called the New Right, which is to say the ways basically that modern conservatism reorganized itself in the 1960s and 70s, particularly around these moral issues like LGBT rights and abortion. And pornography played such a central role in the early New Right. And so that's kind of the window that I was using, you know, as a grad student writing my dissertation, which became my first book called Perversion for Profit. Looking at how conservatives have really mobilized around pornography, partly to enforce reactionary sexual politics, but also to really revive conservatism, which was at sort of a low ebb in that era due to its many failures, as well as the Nixon administration's kind of collapse and what seemed like the end of the Republican Party, which was obviously a premature call. And so that's kind of what got me into, you know, I mean, I basically began writing this as a political historian, but also as a kid who had grown up, you know, kind of immersed in watching porn and being interested in porn culture. And so this, the second part of that story is just that it seems to me that academics who wrote about pornography, and this definitely does not include Jeffrey, whose work I've always admired a lot, but a lot of academics seems to be making sort of sweeping statements based on pretty small samples, you know, rather than being really immersed in porn. It was sort of like Deep Throat and The Devil and Miss Jones stood in for all of straight porn, and maybe Boys in the Sand stood in for all of gay porn in the 70s. But really, you know, these genres are just really diverse and eclectic, and, you know, weird and complicated and problematic in all kinds of ways. And so writing about the films kind of became the direction that I went in. And a few years ago, I co-edited a book with Carolyn Bronstein called Porno Chic and the Sex Wars, about porn in the 1970s during the, you know, the so-called golden era. And so that's where a lot of my work has been in recent years.
Okay, and I thought I'd give you a little background on me. As I said previously while we were talking before going on air, I grew up in the 70s, and I worked at a drive-in. And so I was introduced to a lot of sexploitation, Russ Meyers, that sort of thing. And let me just say this outright. I love porn. And over the years, I have been blessed with getting to know certain people in the industry through podcasts, including Carter Stevens, very, very close to Gene Silver, and Annette Hines, and talked to Richard Pacheco and number. And to me, you're right in one terms, Whitney, because the breadth of stylism within the porn industry is amazing, and a lot of people don't realize, you know, that there are specialty items such as S&M and so on and so forth. They may realize it, but they've not seen it, they've not experienced it. So, you know, this has been something that I've just been fascinated with for years and years and years, and that's one of the reasons we do these podcasts every so often. So I'm very happy to have both of you on. Now let's get back to Jeffrey and take a look at the terms of, like, the historical context, where you start with Boys in the Sand and what happens from there in a historical context.
Well, you know, it actually began a little before Boys in the Sand with it was not hardcore, but Andy Warhol made movies that had a certain degree of male nudity in it. Russ Meyer was a director in the 1950s who made what was called nudie cuties or softcore porn with female nudity. So you know, it's from those sources that eventually, and it seemed to happen almost overnight in the around the time 1969, right around the same time at the Stonewall riots took place, there was a shift from softcore to hardcore. And hardcore involves penetration, oral, anal, and ejaculations and erections and so on. So there was a whole evolution from what were called beaver shorts or movies that were just showed the female vagina, crotch, really, not even the vagina itself. And then it became open. You know, there was a spread the legs, and then eventually you could show a penis, but not erect. And so these evolutions took place, and eventually hardcore hit. And for the gay movies, because they actually sort of almost emerged as part of the porno chic period before the straight movies. And the key movie was Boys in the Sand, which to some degree was meant to be a reaction to Boys in the Band. So kind of homosexuals in New York being unhappy, drinking, and you know, experiencing a great deal of anxiety and depression and guilt. And Boys in the Sand showed shot out on Fire Island, and it showed people, men, having sex in public and out in the outdoors. And it was a very idyllic, almost a utopian vision of gay male life, sex life.
Mm-hmm. So you had that guy Carver. Okay, go ahead.
Pardon me?
I was just going to say there's that dichotomy between the self-loathing in Boys in the Band and a much more joyous presentation in Boys in the Sand.
Oh, yeah. And I think that was deliberate on Wakefield's part. That's what he wanted.
Of course, we're talking about Wakefield Pool for our listeners who don't know.
He was the director. He made Poison Sand was the first porn movie reviewed by Variety, and it began this whole period, and it was shown in a mainstream theater in New York City, and straight gay people went to see it because it was one of the very first hardcore movies shown in public. So basically, that started the whole process, and eventually, people, you know, made more movies, and eventually, a whole industry develops. And this went parallel to the state; they didn't really cross over.
Right, and of course, that also has to do with profitability, and production costs, and all that sort of thing.
Sure,
you know they. Okay, so as far now the one thing I did want to mention, because you didn't mention Andy Milliken at all, because Milliken's work is very seminal in terms of really pushing the soft core almost into hardcore. He of course is a filmmaker that's not only known for his gay content, but also he did a lot of like horror movies and things like that. And anyone who's into cult films should know the name Andy Milliken. So I did want to mention his name also. So Whitney, let's get into a little bit of historical perspective as far as more straight entertainment, whatever you want to call it, straight porn.
Yeah, sure. And I will say I'm a huge Andy Milliken fan. I completely love his work. It's got such a weird sort of misanthropic poetry to it. He did cross over into straight hardcore as well, right? With Fleshpot on 42nd Street, which had Harry Reams in it, the same year that he shot Deep Throat. I would say, you know, just agreeing with everything Jeffrey said, you know, I think one of the things that kind of runs parallel but also distinguishes straight and gay porn, at least in the era we're talking about in the 70s, I mean, gay porn had such an explicit claim to a sort of liberated, you know, gay liberation politics. And I think straight porn tried to make similar claims and was sort of briefly successful at it because, I mean, Deep Throat, which is certainly the sort of canonical title that kind of normalizes and legitimizes hardcore. You know, it's not the first hardcore film, but it's the first sort of extreme household name breakout hit, which comes out in 72 and really, you know, really gets popular in 73. I think it's making similar claims in regard to the sexual revolution, right? The whole subtext of seeing Deep Throat for straight couples and celebrities like Jack Nicholson or, you know, Truman Capote or, you know, whoever they were all going to see it was basically that it was a way of sort of establishing your bona fides as a, you know, member of the sexual revolution who doesn't have hang-ups, right? Even though the film is, deeply complicit in pretty, you know, confined patriarchal sexual values, it's still, in its historical moment was a marker of a sort of, you know, hip, urbane sexual revolution kind of attitude. And in the long run, I don't think that claim proved as sustainable as gay porn's claim to gay liberation, partly because there was a feminist anti-porn movement that developed, which really, you know, kind of called into account some of those facile narratives of sexual liberation that, you know, played out on, for instance, Linda Lovelace's body through performing oral sex on men. You know, certainly as a lot of feminist critics noted, that's a narrative that is pretty literally phallocentric.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the interesting things about straight porn in that period, though, is that it was often political in a way that it would criticize the Nixon administration, for instance, or satirize basically how it was critical, and that you never had in gay porn. You know, gay porn was just purely sort of pleasure and didn't really have, apart from kind of an implicit gay liberation perspective, didn't really have any political dimension, whereas straight porn had that satirical dimension.
Yeah, absolutely. And also a need to justify itself, right? I mean, a need to sort of establish that socially redeeming value that the Supreme Court mandated so that it wouldn't be considered obscene and therefore criminalized, right?
Yeah.
You know, and of course, then you get into the into the Swedish, you know, I am Curious Yellow and Curious Blue and all those that, of course, were up against the courts in pornography, you know, and of course
those were really before hardcore. They weren't hardcore.
No, they weren't hardcore.
Curious Yellow. Yeah. They didn't even have much nudity in them. They were political.
No.
They were leftist.
Yeah, exactly. But again, you know, how the courts view pornography, you know, I mean, that's such a thorny issue. What is pornography? I don't think there's ever been a real definition of it, you know, other than you'll know it when you see it, right? You know, to me, when we look at porn, you know, and of course, you know, there are certainly filmmakers that look at it in a much more artistic or erotic sense. I think we've lost that over the years, but nonetheless, you know, in straight porn, if you talk about Bradley Metzger and his Henry Paris days, or mm-hmm. you know, Alex Renzi, or any of these people out there, and certainly it's true of Wakefield Poole and various directors. I think, you know, it's all within how you look at it. You know, how do you guys look at the censorship and how people look at pornography and how people, you know, the political end of it and the moral majority end of it?
Whit, that's you. It sounds like.
All right. Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah, I wrote a book on obscenity law called Obscenity Rules about the Roth case, Roth v. U.S., which was decided in 1957 and is the foundational case for U.S. obscenity law because it basically permanently decided that obscenity did not fall within the protections of the First Amendment, right? And so we've tweaked the formula in various kind of tiny ways ever since, but that fundamental holding still remains true today, right? That if material is determined to be obscene, it doesn't have a First Amendment claim and can be criminalized, and that doesn't constitute censorship. And so, yeah, I mean, it, you know, just to go back to something Jeffrey had mentioned before, you know, all of that incremental change in the 1960s as we see full frontal nudity and then beaver movies and then erections, I mean, each of that happens directly in response to a series of Supreme Court cases, right? So basically each year over the course of the 60s, the court gets just a tiny bit more lenient, and then, you know, film distributors immediately test those boundaries, which is why 1970 is really when hardcore emerges. And so, yeah, I mean, the sort of politicization of that by the right has always been a pretty simplistic equation, really. I mean, going on, honestly, all the way back to the 1870s when Anthony Comstock was in charge of anti-porn activism, and in 1873, the first meaningful federal law against obscenity gets passed in his name, the Comstock Act. And fundamentally, it's always been about just sort of suppressing sexual expression as this kind of fear that, you know, sort of rampant sexuality is going to destabilize the social institutions that conservatives value, you know, the heterosexual, procreative, monogamous nuclear family and the single family household as the basis of our kind of social structure. And so I think that, you know, that's the sort of political valence that pornography took in regard to the new right in the 70s. I mean,
yeah,
feminist critique is more nuanced. But, yeah, go ahead, Jeffrey, please.
No, in addition, so, you know, even though the Roth case basically did not offer any protection to obscenity, a way around it, a workaround developed, because if it had socially redeeming qualities, it would be acceptable. And so what I mean, and basically the standard for that was lower and lower and lower, what was socially redeeming. So that's where in the early days of porn, the stories, the comedy, the political stuff, all those were ways or were kind of alibis for making something sexually explicit, but that had some kind of social redeeming dimension. And, you know, eventually, I mean, a lot of other things also took place. For instance, the movies during the first era was Behind the Green Door, Deep Throat, and a number, and Boys in the Band, and so on. All those movies ended up making much more than movies that were produced by Hollywood. So at some point, Hollywood also gets into the picture and develops the rating system, and as a way to sort of segregate porn and keep it out of mainstream theaters. So there were all these things going on. I personally think that all the debates around porn and the increasing sexual expression that became possible, because it wasn't just porn that was considered obscene, all kinds of things. Lenny Bruce, a comedy.
I'm such a Bruce fan, and
so
what they did to him.
All those debates around sexual expression, I think, were what basically launched the sexual revolution.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jeffrey, one thing we haven't gotten into yet is this social impact of porn. And I think that the social impact of gay porn is particularly interesting in terms of, you know, mentioned the political sense of it, but also, you know, identity and all these type of things. So why don't you talk a bit about that?
Sure. I mean, so there's a way in which gay porn, in a way, was much more important for gay men than straight porn was to straight men, in terms of their basically their sense of self-worth, their identities, because the kind of pornography that existed before hardcore gay porn was called beefcake, and it was basically pictures of muscly guys in very skimpy clothing, and that was for many years the kind of erotic literature. And what happened when the shift from beefcake to hardcore meant that you finally had, because beefcake is just really, it takes a kind of muscular male image, and it's an object of desire, but the gay man is passive or implicitly passive. Whereas once you get to hardcore, you see gay men actually fucking, and that means that they're sexually active, which was not able to be portrayed in the beefcake era. And so for gay men, it showed sexual activity. It showed actual sex. It showed them in idyllic surroundings, in a positive light. And so it had a kind of, I think, an extra charge that the straight porn didn't ever quite have.
You know, and it's about liberation, too, because back in my day, we have a mutual friend who I love dearly. His name is Richard Wandel. And Richard, back in the 80s, I was privy to meet Vito Russo. And Vito and I had a couple of quick conversations, but the one thing that really, you know, hit me in learning about, you know, how gays were portrayed, you know, or you know, the types, the sissy types, and so on and so forth, were very, very derogatory. And and so you have this history of derogatory images throughout film, and then suddenly, even when you go into Boys in the Band and that, there's still a lot of self-loathing being shown, and so on and so forth, and this this sense of idyllic celebration that you see in gay films with Wakefield Pool and various others in that era, it must have been such a liberating sense, you know, that suddenly you can celebrate what you are, right?
It was. I mean, that's what's important. And it wasn't just celebrating some vague idea of self. It was actually celebrating the sexual self, too. And so, you know, and I do believe that even that pornography, straight pornography as well, had beneficial effects on many aspects of both straight male and gay male life. But, you know, and because in part porn films can't show as easily or adequately the way female pleasure is expressed, the way males have ejaculations, erections, and so on, those make porn movies much more directly express male sexuality.
So do you want to weigh in on this, Whitney, at all?
Yeah, sure. I mean, honestly, I think my favorite layer of all of these politics, you know, again, in the 1970s specifically around gay porn is really then the critique that emerges out of gay liberation circles, which is essentially an anti-capitalist critique, right? That, you know, these seemingly sexually affirmative images are actually, you know, in the way that the social theorist Herbert Marcuse kind of envisioned a steam valve in order to commodify sexuality and sort of recontain it within acceptable kind of, you know, commodity structures that don't fundamentally challenge existing power. And so, you know, that's a critique that's going to be made against Wakefield Pool for trying to capitalize on gay liberation and Fred Halstead. And, you know, I think that debate, it's a much richer debate in some ways than the debate that plays out around straight porn, which essentially, you know, on the right is it anti-family? And then on the feminist left is more, you know, is it misogynist? And not that those are not important questions, especially the feminist critique, it is. But the way it plays out, you know, I think is not as nuanced in some ways as the gay debate that runs parallel to it, but quite separate.
Which is about standardization of certain standards of beauty and commodification, and
It's funny how, you know, I'm much more knowledgeable on straight porn, but the one thing that I would say is that it devolved into just, you know, showing cum shots. And I think we lose a lot of enjoyment out of that, or story or anything like that. They're no longer films. I mean, certainly now that's true. You know, what you find online. But the one thing I would say about straight porn is that, particularly in the early period, you know, you're talking about, you know, from the gay perspective, this idyllic sense of celebration and such. But being straight and watching straight porn, to me, in the 70s particularly, there was no sense of this is the ideal female or this is the ideal male. There was a sense that
that's
everybody,
early porn, both straight and gay. I think you're right.
Right. And that to me is, you know, that's when I grew up, and that's you know, came of age in the 70s. And so seeing porn at that point in time, you know, particularly when you have a kid who's so, you know, just, you know, not sure of himself and that sort of thing. You see just regular people. You know, I think we've gotten to a point where we fetishize so much what the perfect look is, you know, and that's certainly true when it gets into the 80s. That I think that's something that has been lost over the years.
Another dimension, it seems to me, and I think this, you know, had sort of a general effect on both gay men and straight men, although I think straight men much more, and that is in the early stages when porn was shot on film, it was shown in theaters, and people went to see porn in theaters. And the theaters themselves often had people having sex with one another. So it might be a straight film, but there might be men in the audience having sex with one another. Some of those men straight, some of those men gay. Also, prostitutes used to work porn theaters in the early days. And, you know, a young man recently told me that he said that he does, straight man told me that he can't enjoy a porn scene if he doesn't see the male erection, and that is part now of his imagination. So one of the things that I think, you know, was one of the impacts of seeing a straight man to see porn movies is he sees men having sex, men with erections, men, you know, fucking women. He sees that, and so that, you know, normally probably before porn, that wouldn't have been something that he was part of his sexual imagination.
Right, and so that's very true. Well, I can actually attest to that. I don't know how many times I went to Show World or, you know. But there's no question about that. And
so basically, sexual experience broadened and they became aware of other sexualities. I mean, Samuel Delaney, a science fiction writer, wrote a book about his experiences going to porn theaters in Times Square, in which he felt like it broadened everyone's range of social experience.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I love Dahlgren. His one novel, Dahlgren. I think it's a masterpiece. But that's very true, because I think, you know, the sense of broadening and the sense of understanding that if we look at sexuality in such a way, suddenly the walls are breaking down in front of you because you understand that you can get pleasure in different ways.
Yeah.
And that other people do that also. Would you both agree with that statement?
I do. I also saw it, you know, because I spent a lot of time in the porn world and the production of porn movies. I constantly came across people expanding and exploring all different kinds of sexual behaviors, and no matter where you started.
Mm-hmm. You know, I also think that particular decade, the 70s, was rife for that. You know, that there would be experimentation on film, and then you would experiment yourself, and that's very true of me. You know, and I make no bones about that. Whitney, what do you have to add to this?
Yeah, I mean, I broadly agree. I think, you know, I think one has to be wary of being too uncritical toward porn films, which are, you know, totally inseparable from larger structures of, you know, patriarchy, homophobia, misogyny, ableism, racism, etc. And so that's always got to be a sort of caveat that, you know, we don't lose sight of in sort of romanticizing some golden era of the past. But that being said, I definitely do broadly agree that, yeah, I mean, hardcore films being screened in public, both, you know, to what Jeffrey said about Samuel Delaney, who I also love, you know, I mean, he very compellingly framed that as a sort of democratic sexual public sphere in which, you know, unlike our very rigidly segregated society at large, there was more, you know, cross class contact, you know, multiracial contact, still fairly gendered, you know, it was still an exclusionary space for women. And I think, you know, that needs to stay into the equation. But yeah, I think if you look at straight hardcore in the 70s, I mean, you know, you do see something whose sexual imaginary is fairly limited to a fairly masculinist and fairly phallocentric sexual imaginary, but not entirely. I mean, you know, you see people like Georgina Spelvin and Annie Sprinkle, who, no matter what the script, you know, delegates to them, they still bring very much their own sort of exuberance and agency to the characters they play and really embody, you know, sort of women's desires and pleasures in ways that I think exceed what the films sometimes intend, but in really productive and creative ways. So, yeah, and, you know, I think that gets easily lost out of the equation, too, in some of the subsequent sort of, you know, debates over pornography, but it is important to note.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that. My background, again, I mentioned Long Gene Silver. Gene and I have had conversations over the years, both in podcasts and through PMs and that. And that brings us to another subject of the performers that you've met. You know, there seems to be this stereotype of you know, on the straight sense of self-hating women who get involved in this and then turn their back or whatever the case, or the sense of male performers and gay. And the thing is, a lot of that, there's a lot of gray area in terms of how performers, you know, react toward their performance in films and being in the pornography business. What, with the people that you've talked to and that, what do you see as far as, you know, the reactions? Is it negative? Is it positive? Or is it a combination of both? Or whatever the case would be. We'll start with you, Whit, on this one.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, you know, I think one's got to be wary of generalizations, right? I mean, on the one hand, there's absolutely a strain of these, you know, incredibly creative, transgressive, subversive performers, you know, like Annie Sprinkle, like Nina Hartley, you know, bringing a real sort of queer and feminist consciousness even to straight porn. And you know, I think that's something to really recognize and celebrate. You know, on the other hand, you know, I think I've probably beaten this drum a few times already, but it's worth just reiterating, right? I mean, this is a capitalist industry, and capitalist labor relations are fundamentally defined by exploitation and alienation, and there's no reason that pornography ought to be separated from that. You know, it's not insulated from those kind of labor practices, and so the lack of a union, the sort of criminalization of the industry, you know, I think all of those do leave some performers, you know, sort of ripe to exploitation and abuse. And, you know, I think that's a good reason to decriminalize sex work and to fight for things like unions in the adult industry.
Well, and also I do think that a lot of the people who go into it with open eyes nowadays, particularly, and I think particularly the women are very conscious of the issues that have been raised by various anti-porn movements and feminist movements over the period. But also, I think that there is a constant movement in which the people in the industry try to organize. They haven't succeeded in a big way. There is a trade association that represents performers for the most part, called the Free Speech Association. And it provides legal aid and stuff like that, but it's not a union. And then there was also, for many years, HIV testing that was done founded by women in the industry. And that was actually in a big, ugly political fight in Los Angeles. That was actually forced to close down, and because one of the big differences between the straight industry and the gay industry after HIV became prevalent was that the straight industry tested but did not use condoms, whereas the gay industry used condoms. So that was a very big difference between those two industries. And really, within the straight industry, women led the whole fight to improve the health condition. So, and that was destroyed by a male-run AIDS organization because the industry didn't, they thought that they should be using condoms, and these people in the industry didn't want to use condoms. So they tested regularly. I had friends who, you couldn't be in a movie if you didn't have a test like before the movie.
Go ahead and finish, then I'm going to pop in.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry, Don.
Okay. So I had a podcast with Richard Pacheco, and one of the things that he mentioned was at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, he's out on the West Coast, and he said there were a few of us male performers who refused to do movies without using condoms. And he was one that pushed for that, along with a number of the female people out there. And there was a period of time where he would not do it. He got out of the business for a good 4 or 5 years before the straight porn industry decided that you had to use condoms. So I don't know if you knew that or not, if you've ever talked to Richard.
No, I know pretty much the history in both gay and straight sides, but the gay side wasn't really much better. It took them a long time to begin to use, to insist on condoms. And, I do think that there was a very significant role of the industry, the Adult Industry AIDS Foundation, to really try to manage the health, the health conditions. So, there's been battles back and forth. Some people, insisted on using condoms, and there were a lot of different policies, and there was no one policy. In general, it became eventually gay industry used condoms, straight industry didn't. But the straight industry tested the gay industry used condoms.
Mm-hmm.
But, I think this all goes to show some of the things that I think Whit was pointing to, which are that there are, it's a business, it's run like a capitalist business, and so there was constant kind of struggle that goes on, and there are, very limited successes because of the power of the industry. Many, many large corporations, would be involved in the porn industry, but because they were buried in little companies that didn't get any kind of publicity, there was no way for the actors in the industry to get any kind of power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of us, one of the things that you bring out very much, the two of you, is the sense of, the capitalist structure of it. And I think a lot of people, when the average male takes a look at straight porn or gay porn, they don't think of that, but it is a business. And when we take a look at the sense of the business structure of it, and of course, earlier, of course, you have a lot of illegal money and things involved in it. It's somewhat underhanded, might as well say the word mafia. But that has changed, has it not, to a certain degree? I mean, it's become more legal in sense or more...
I think there's still a fair amount of money laundering that goes on. I think there are definitely exploitative, and I think, I mean, the big shift that took place, of course, the shift to the internet, and that changed a lot of things, because to some degree, that for at least for the gay porn business, all the big companies basically either went out of business or merged into with one another, and are not as important as they once were. At one time, Falcon Films, was the largest gay business in the country.
Yeah, that's very true.
Powerful. But it's nothing now.
You know, is that because everything has turned into self-entrepreneurship in terms that you own a website?
To some degree.
And, okay.
But you also have big companies like, I think I forget the name of it, it owns MindGeek, something. MindGeek. And then you have Pornhub, which is a huge company and is one of the largest porn sites in the world.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Yes, we.
So
most of us know Pornhub. Trust me.
Pornhub is very large, and you know it's a business. People aren't paid very well. They're not taken care of. You know, there's all kinds of things. So it's changed, but to some degree, I think performers are less significant than they once were. So I don't think there's really the porn super porn star anymore.
No, that's very true. That's very true. It's become much more generic and just, oh, we'll see this scene, we'll see that scene, we'll find that type of porn 5 minutes. You know, there's no story, there's no sense of star, which I think is unfortunate to say the least. Of course, you know, I mean, we don't want to look back, you know, in a purple haze saying that, you know, this was so great, but nonetheless, I think we've lost something over the years. What do you have to say about this part of the conversation?
Yeah, no, I do think that this sort of 21st century shift toward basically more of a gig work economy, absolutely reflects those dynamics. I think that's something that a few scholars have begun to pay attention to, and it's one thing that I think, you know, Jeffrey's work really is sort of pioneering in this way, because so often scholars who had looked at pornography looked more in terms of textual analysis, right? I'm going to read this film and I'm going to sort of decode its meaning, rather than thinking about the kind of structures we're talking about here, right? And so, you know, in the last few years, there has been this body of work, you know, like Lynn Camella has written about camming, and Angela Jones also writes about it. Murray Miller Young writes about black women in pornography. And the scholar Heather Berg has a really exciting looking book coming out called Porn Work. But, you know, Jeffrey's new book is a collection of his essays, some of which are very recent and some of which go back a little while. And, you know, as somebody who's been reading this work for some time, I feel like, you know, almost nobody was doing the kind of work that's actually collected in this book, which is really specifically about some of these questions. It's about, you know, what pornography as labor, right, as sex work,
yeah.
And the kind of conditions of production that structure it. I've learned a lot from reading, you know, everybody I just mentioned, but especially Jeffrey's work on this. And, I guess that's one thing I would say.
Yeah, I've always been interested
in
the work life of porn people and porn. And that's one of the, I would say that's, along with the historical, that's the other main emphasis of my work.
Okay, so since we're talking about books that you've all written, why don't we take a little bit of time promote what you've written? So, Jeffrey, you have a new book coming February, right?
Yeah, so I have a book called Sex, Society, and the Making of Pornography that is coming out in February. from Rutgers University Press. Previous to that, I've written a history of the gay porn industry called Bigger Than Life, the gay porn cinema from beefcake to hardcore. And that's a regular history, starting with Andy Warhol and coming up to basically to the period just before the shift to the internet. Those are the
And is that book still valuable?
Electronically, it can be. It's available as a Kindle. I think it's out of print, but you can still buy it on Amazon.
Okay. And how about you, Whitney?
Yeah, sure. I don't have anything too exciting coming out right at the moment, so nothing new. But this month, actually, I just realized a few days ago, is the 10-year anniversary of my first book, which I guess came out in December of 2010. So, I mentioned a while ago, Perversion for Profit, which is about the politics of pornography and the rise of the new right. It looks at, the 1960s and groups like Citizens for Decent Literature, the rise of the moral majority and the Reagan era when he had a commission in the 80s, the Mies Commission, which was specifically designed to reach the conclusion that pornography constituted a social harm in ways that kind of co-opted feminist discourse without any of the feminism attached. That I've got two books that have come out since. I mean, one is Obscenity Rules, which is a history of obscenity law, mostly in the 20th century, kind of combined with the history of Samuel Roth, this underground publisher who started out in the 1920s bohemian world of kind of modernist poetry and culture, but because he bootlegged James Joyce's Ulysses, got blacklisted and turned to smut, and then wound up in this, kind of crucial Supreme Court case. The final thing that I've done somewhat recently is the book I mentioned with Carolyn Bronstein, Porno Chic and the Sex Wars, which I really enjoyed because it was an edited collection, and so it allowed us to basically recruit a bunch of people that we admired and liked to contribute essays. And so it's got a bunch of really great scholars in it, like Lucas Hildebrand, who also writes about gay porn, and Peter Alalunas, who writes about the rise of VHS and the ways that kind of reshaped the market in the 80s. That's basically kind of a short, condensed version of what I've got to offer here.
And of course, you mentioned a couple of different authors. Jeffrey, would you suggest any other authors for our listeners to check out as far as the history and the social implications of gay porn? Anyone that you would recommend?
That is in process is there's a man named Jerry Douglas who was a lot, right around the same time that Wakefield Poole made Boys in the Sand. He made a movie set in New York called The Front, The Back Row, rather. And that movie was, I think it showed in the theater right after Boys in the Sand. He was not only a director who won many, many awards. He made about 10 or 12 very, very important gay porn movies with storylines and shot like real movies. He was also a writer and an editor, and he founded a magazine called Man Shots, and he edited a couple of other magazines, and he interviewed almost all the key directors who made gay porn throughout from the 70s on up through the 90s. And he interviewed performers. And so he's got hundreds of pages. And those are all in the process of being published now. So one is called Directing Sex, which is a series of interviews with gay directors. Another one is called Close-Up Interviews with the performers in gay pornography, and those are both in the process of coming out, both available on Amazon now, and from a publisher in Germany called Editions Mustache. So those books, I helped edit those books, and those books are in the process of coming out, and there's, I think, two more volumes, and I think Whit's going to be writing an introduction to one of those, and So anyway, so that's a very important series of publications currently in the process of being published.
Okay, good, good. Well, gentlemen, I really appreciate you being on. I think what we should do now is just give a last comment from each of you in terms of, you know, why you think, you know, porn is important, or the social implications, or however you want to wrap it up. So we'll start with you, Jeffrey.
Well, I think porn is an important kind of entertainment. And like all entertainment, it's not perfect. And it's made by exploitative companies, but it's a perfectly viable and significant and important form of entertainment.
Okay. And you, Whitney?
Yeah, sure. You know, I think in a lot of ways, I think you started the show off actually by saying something about, you know, pornography and sex are slightly different and yet overlapping things, right? And, you know,
yeah.
I think it's true that, you know, thinking here just as an historian, I mean, I think you couldn't really tell the history of sex by watching pornography, but you can sort of chart the history of the sexual imagination, the kind of dominant but also marginal and transgressive kind of views of what desire ought to look like. And that's an interesting project. And I mean, I think, you know, as we've kind of discussed, that does also shape people's own subjective experiences of desire and sexuality in ways that are, mm-hmm. you know, really hard to sort of concretely document, but that are real. And so, yeah, in that sense, I think pornography is a really valuable archive of the sexual imaginary. So, yeah, I think that's probably what I would say.
You know, and what I would say, you know, from more of a purveyor sense, is that, you know, there is a release to be given through pornography, of course, that if you are unattached or that sort of thing, that certainly is helpful to a certain degree. But also, you know, it's much more than that. Because as we mentioned in terms of, you know, if you saw something in a theater or that sort of thing, it can open up new areas of interest and that sort of thing, and give you a sense of exploration. It can also shut you off too. So you have to be careful. But is it useful? I would say absolutely. No question at all. Gentlemen, I really want to thank you for being on. And certainly, you know, if we ever want to do a follow-up or that, you're more than welcome to come back on. I think this has been a wonderful program. I really appreciate it, guys.
Well, thank you
so
for
much.
Having
good
me.
Good to be here.
Yeah.
Okay. And just before we leave, I want to do a little bit of housekeeping here. So tomorrow, Adam Ferenz in the Cathode Ray Mission on Deviant Legion will be doing a whole podcast on The Prisoner, of which I'll be part of. And then on Tuesday, we are going to have Danny Perry on. Danny is an author. He wrote the three cult movie books. He also wrote a number of baseball books, which we'll at least nod towards because I'm such a baseball fanatic. But the ISF podcast, The Incredibly Strange Films, will have Danny Perry. And then the week after, coming on to Christmas, we're going to be doing a lot of different commentary watches and things like that. Getting ready for Christmas. Oh, my goodness gracious. So please stick with us during the holidays. And again, I want to thank Jeffrey Escoffier and Whitney Strupp for being with us tonight. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, and again, we'll see you later. Good night, everyone.
Say good night, gentlemen. Good night.
Bye.